Hi, I'm Shashank Bhargav, and you're listening to Three Things, the Indian Express news show. In this episode, we talk about death penalties and how its proceedings are carried out. We also talk about the Mumbai police finding a new cybercrime hotspot. But first, we talk about the controversy that has been going on in Maharashtra. Earlier this year, the Indian mining conglomerate Vedanta partnered with Foxconn, which is a Taiwanese manufacturing giant, to set up a semiconductor chip factory, a project which is said to be worth 1.5 lakh crore rupees. Now, semiconductor chips are essential for all kinds of electronic devices, including smartphones, laptops, and even cars. In fact, because of supply chain issues during the pandemic, there had been a shortage of them in India, and a lot of companies faced problems due to it. So this new venture is supposed to help India become more self-reliant as far as electronics are concerned. But this venture has been at the center of a political storm. The thing is that Vedanta and Foxconn had initially planned to set up the factory in Maharashtra. They even had late-stage meetings with the state government, which currently is a coalition between the BJP and the rebel MLAs of the Shiv Sena. But when everyone thought that the deal was going to get sealed, this happened last week.
Mining major Vedanta and electronics manufacturing giant Foxconn will together set up a semiconductor manufacturing unit in Gujarat.
Vedanta and Foxconn have signed a memorandum of understanding with the Gujarat government.
And this will be a big boost for Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Atmanirbhar Bharat mission. This is a big development.
Now, this came as a big surprise to the Maharashtra government, who was confident that the project would be set up in the state. And since then, the opposition has been blaming it for costing the state a huge employment opportunity. And this includes Shiv Sena leader Aditya Thackeray.
जो इन्वेस्टमेंट महाराष्ट्र में 100 टक्का आने वाली थी, जो इन्वेस्टमेंट यहाँ और 160 से 200 कंपनियां लाने वाली थी, लगभग 1 लाख रोजगार की संधियां उपलब्ध करने वाली थी, लेकिन ऐसी सरकार ऐसी इन्वेस्टमेंट को भगा कैसे सकती है? ये तो एक फैक्ट फाइंडिंग की बात हुई। मुझे लगता है इसके पीछे एक ही कारण है कि जो अभी व्यवस्था है वो सिर्फ राजनीति में लगी हुई है, जुटी हुई है और घूम रही है, लेकिन काम तो कुछ हो रहा नहीं।
In this segment, we speak to Indian Express's Shubhangi Khapre, who reports on Maharashtra politics, about this development and what we know about it so far. Shubhangi, even though we are talking about it now, Devendra Fadnavis, for example, had been talking to Foxconn for some time, right? And really wanted this project to be in Maharashtra. So what exactly happened?
Yeah, I'll give you the chronology. 30th of June, Eknath Shinde took the oath of Chief Minister. Devendra Fadnavis took the oath of Deputy Chief Minister. And on 14th of June, Devendra Fadnavis wrote official letter to Vedanta and Foxconn. And on 15th, a letter was written by Chief Minister. So there were two separate letters that went from both of them, expressing their desire to have the company here and willing to kind of hold discussions and basically give all incentives and give everything they wanted, that kind of thing. And again, formally on 26th of July, it was followed and a delegation from Foxconn Vedanta came. They made the presentation before the CM and DCM. Devendra Fadnavis at the meeting told them that we are willing to tailor make the package you want, including the land, including the other logistics like the subsidies in the power sector and other whatever was required infrastructure. I mean, so very specifically said that Maharashtra is very keen to have this project and at no cost this project should be considered anywhere other than Maharashtra. It was very, very clearly spelled out. But then apparently they were conveyed that the talks with Gujarat were already in advanced stage and for some reasons they will not be able to pull out from the commitment given to Gujarat.
Yeah, and this happened even though Devendra Fadnavis had very good relations with Vedanta and its chairperson Anil Agarwal, and he had even gone to his house to talk about the deal. But the other thing is that despite other states like Tamil Nadu, Telangana, Karnataka and even Gujarat being in competition for this project, Maharashtra was considered the preferred state for it, right?
Yes, and even before Shinde Fadnavis government came in Maharashtra, that is since June 30th, The previous government, that is Mahavikas Agadi government led by Uddhav Thackeray, even they were in talks with them. And at that time, the former Deputy Chief Minister Ajit Pawar is on record saying that the government had allocated, identified 1,000 acre land in Talegaon, that is in Pune district. And the talks were at advanced stage. The Mahavikas Agadi's Industries Minister, that is Subhash Desai, he himself had discussions with Vedanta Foxconn, I think during his visit to Davos. And kind of a commitment was also elicited from them. And they were also keen on having the semiconductor plant in Maharashtra. And talks were there, and the only condition at that time, which Subhash Desai mentioned, is that they said that, oh, we are fine with everything in Maharashtra. Now, only we need a consent from center. That was only a condition, which they had expressed before him during his meeting. And that was much before this government came. So, yes, Maharashtra was the chosen destination by Vedanta Foxconn.
Right, and it remained the preferred destination despite the change in government earlier this year. But the project still went to Gujarat. Do we know why that happened? Why the sudden change?
So it's very clear from here, if you see that the Gujarat elections are on, the assembly elections are at the end of this year. And I think there's some way it is very, it's not being said very clearly, but the fact is for Gujarat assembly elections, the BJP leadership that is at center as well as Gujarat state, they need some mega project, some big ticket project, which they want to showcase for the elections to kind of, you know, make appeal to the people to show that they are really doing something for the employment and they're bringing huge investments in the state. And I think this whole decision to shift the project, or we'll say to get Vedanta Foxconn to Gujarat, keeping the Gujarat elections in mind, I think that was the main reason.
Right, and this is what the opposition is saying as well, that the state government has essentially surrendered to Prime Minister Narendra Modi because he's from Gujarat and the fact that elections are soon going to take place there. And there also seems to be anger because the project was supposed to bring 80,000 to 1 lakh direct and indirect job opportunities to the state, over 26,000 crore rupees worth of state goods and service tax, $21 billion of direct investment and additional indirect investment, and more than 150 companies across the value chain would have benefited from it as well, which is a lot. So when we talk about the reasons why the project went to Gujarat, have Vedanta and Foxconn said anything about it?
Look, I mean, for any corporate head, so, you know, any corporate companies, whether it's multinationals or domestic, you know, for them, they will not like to antagonize the leadership, you know, the ruling parties. And specifically when it comes to prime minister level, you know, somebody who's a prime minister, I mean, they will not like to do anything that goes or that gives a message that, you know, they're working against their interest or against their wishes. I mean, it's across the world. No corporate company will ever try to antagonize somebody who's at the helm of the affair of a nation, basically. And this is very clear. So I think the Vedanta Foxconn must have been in dilemma. I mean, they are not going to speak about it so frankly, but the fact remains that, yes, there was this political pressure, or let's say that not pressure, at least some kind of assurance that consider this project in Gujarat. Because Vedanta Foxconn, I don't think had ever considered Gujarat as second, not even third option. So when the project goes there, there is ground to suspect, yes, there's something more to it than just, you know, I mean, the obvious reason is the Gujarat assembly elections.
Yeah, and you have written that Maharashtra does have a record of being the preferred choice for companies, right, when it comes to doing business in the state?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. If you look at the entire trends, Maharashtra is the most preferred destination as far as projects are concerned. Whether it's FDI or whether it's domestic investors, Maharashtra has remained number one. And I'll give you an example. Like when Make in India happened in 2015, it was inaugurated by Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Of the total MOUs, 15 lakh crore MOUs that were signed, 8 lakh crore were for Maharashtra state alone. So in that sense, yeah, because Maharashtra has Mumbai, which is the economic capital of India, plus Pune, Nasik, Aurangabad are the three major industrial developed regions. And in terms of logistic, in terms of also politically conducive atmosphere, the availability of labor, the infrastructure is very good. So from all these aspects, I think, and the multinationals, the big ticket projects are always choose Maharashtra as number one destination.
Right, because even when Vedanta and Foxconn were looking at different states, One of the problems with Gujarat had been that it did not have enough skilled manpower, for example. But now that this last-minute change was made and the project did go to Gujarat, what do political leaders and those following this development make of it?
There's a sense that is gaining ground here that Narendra Modi and Amit Shah, Home Minister, they are not willing to look beyond Gujarat. I mean, the criticism from the opposition is that, you know, you are Prime Minister, you have a Home Minister of the nation. I mean, for Gujarat Assembly elections, you cannot take away a project from Maharashtra. And in some sense, if this kind of narrative which opposition is setting in, if that catches the imagination of the people in Maharashtra, I think it's going to be very difficult for state BJP to kind of counter it in coming elections. So I think the central leadership probably is overlooking all these facts right now because their focused agenda must be Gujarat Assembly elections. And the understanding given is, well, we will compensate with a bigger project for Maharashtra. But then, you know, it's not going to be so easy because probably this 1.5 lakh crore semiconductor project is not something like just an investment. It's a very futuristic project. And to find a suitable replacement at this scale so soon is not going to happen. That is a fact.
Yeah, because after the project went to Gujarat, Chief Minister Eknath Shinde said that PM Modi has promised him an even bigger project for the state. But talk about this position that both Shinde and Fadnavis find themselves in.
I mean, the fact is that both Chief Minister and Deputy Chief Minister are upset about it. Upset because, not because it went to Gujarat or it would have gone to any other state. But the point is, you know, for them to defend the state is getting difficult. And also in some way the central leadership has been taking decisions, it gives reasons to believe that, yes, Maharashtra somewhere is getting a secondary treatment. Firstly, you know, Mumbai was the chosen destination for International Financial Services Center. And it was announced in Parliament, Indian Parliament, by then Congress regime. P. Chidambaram was the finance minister then. And then, of course, it was pursued by Prithviraj Chauhan, who was the chief minister. Then when Fadnavis came as a BJP chief minister, he aggressively pushed this International Financial Services Center at BKC, that's Bandra Kurla Complex. And then suddenly you have this gift city coming up in Gujarat, and they started staking claim for Financial Services Center vis-a-vis Maharashtra or Mumbai. So there's this background to this, you know. Like, so now the opposition is in some way rightly saying that, you know, the center is trying to take away everything that rightly belongs to Mumbai or that rightly belongs to Maharashtra. They're citing these instances like International Financial Services Center and then this bullet train. I mean, what was the need of having a bullet train only between Mumbai and Ahmedabad? Why not Mumbai and, say, Kolkata? Or why not Mumbai and Nagpur? So in some way, the BJP central leadership has given reasons for the opposition to kind of, you know, settle scores.
And Shubhangi, right now people have been talking a lot about federal relations and BJP's double-engine Sarkar. What concerns do you think it raises for Maharashtra and even other states where this might happen?
Look, the larger question here is, like, you know, whether you have a double-engine system or you have CM, deputy CM, you have coalition governments, the issue is, what does the state benefit? I mean, see, ultimately, whatever kind of politics you're pushing, the point is, ultimately, if it is at the cost of welfare of the state, welfare of the people, then that kind of politics will not withstand for very long. Because someday, after some years, the people are going to reject you. So here, the first test of the central leadership to justify the Operation Lotus in Maharashtra would have been to allow Foxconn and Vedanta project to come to Maharashtra. Had they shown that kind of large-heartedness, you know, had the central leadership showed the large-heartedness to allow this project not only to retain in Maharashtra, but also helped to kind of ensure that the project remains in Maharashtra, that would have given them a huge mileage. Because, you know, it would have shown that, yes, the whatever has happened, the formation of the new government by dislodging the Mahavikas Aghadi government is for the well-being of the Maharashtra, for the welfare of the state of Maharashtra. They're talking about investments, they're talking about employment. But when you don't do that, you know, when you're seen as driving away a big project away from Maharashtra And shortly after this kind of Operation Lotus, this is not going to go well with the people. So all these are going to be the issues which the ruling Shinde and Fadnavis government will have to kind of grapple. And it's going to be a huge, huge challenge, because the first biggest challenge will be the BMC elections, that is in early 2023. There are 24 to 27 corporation elections across Maharashtra. Then 2024, they have to go for the Lok Sabha elections and assembly elections. And Maharashtra is the second largest state with maximum Lok Sabha seats of 48. So I don't know. I mean, it's like a huge, huge political challenge for Fadnavis right now.
And next we talk about the death penalty. The Supreme Court is soon planning to take a decision on how death penalty cases should be heard. The top court earlier this week decided to refer the matter to a 5-judge constitution bench. In this segment, Indian Express's Apurva Vishwanath, who writes on law for the paper, joins us to talk about it. Apurva, could you begin by talking about how and in what cases are death sentences typically awarded in India?
So there are a host of provisions under the Indian Penal Code under which you can be awarded the death sentence. I mean, this includes treason, kidnapping for ransom, attempted murder, and rape of a child below 12 years, or the gang rape of child below 12 years. These are all offenses for which you can be awarded the death penalty. We also have some special legislations like the Narcotics, Drugs and Psychotropic Substances Act, the UAPA, under which you can also be awarded the death sentence. Of course, this wouldn't say mandatory death sentence. There is some legislations which require you to carry out a mandatory death sentence and some which leave a discretion to the judges to choose between a range of sentences, the highest of which is the capital punishment.
Right. And recently, a 3-judge bench of the Supreme Court said that there are conflicting judgments on when and how the sentencing hearings of death penalties must take place. And because there are conflicting judgments, they said that the matter should be now referred to a larger bench, a 5-judge bench. So what are these conflicting judgments?
Right. So, you know, after conviction, an accused is given sentencing hearing. And in this sentencing hearing, the judge will have to decide what are the aggravating and mitigating circumstances. Why is a punishment like the death sentence necessitated in a particular case, and why the death sentence should not be allowed. So the CRPC has a provision for a separate sentencing hearing in all crimes. But it becomes very important in cases of death penalty because it is, of course, as we know, the ultimate punishment, and which is also irrevocable in a sense. It's a question of life and death. So the sentencing hearing becomes very important in cases where the punishment could be the death sentence. So usually what we see in many cases is, although there is consensus on having a separate sentencing hearing, judges tend to have these on the same day of conviction, which is almost like they're happening simultaneously, right? So it restrains the accused, because if he makes a pitch for a lesser sentence, then it can be looked at as an admission of guilt. But if he is pleading not guilty, then he cannot argue on sentencing. So there are a lot of issues around this on when the sentencing hearing should take place. Of course, there are also guidelines of the Supreme Court which say that in the sentencing hearing, the accused must be given an opportunity to put forward all the mitigating circumstances. That could be the social milieu he comes from, his age, the dependents of his family who are dependent on this accused, for example, educational background, and all these issues which are intrinsically linked to crime, right? Why somebody commits a crime. So a judge will have to look at all these things and then decide on whether the death sentence is warranted or not. But if it happens on the same day, the accused does not get a chance to put forward this material, or the judge does not get time to, you know, look into this material, even if it is put forward before him.
Yeah, and you write that this is the issue on which there is a difference of opinion in the judgments that we have. What have these judgments said?
So there are some verdicts which have said that the same day sentencing is okay, but some judgments in which the Supreme Court has in fact commuted the death sentence to life imprisonment solely on the reason that the accused did not get a fair chance to present his case in the sentencing hearing. So this is something that the court wants to sort of settle the law on this issue and also develop this clarity in law on when the sentencing hearing should take place. In the same case earlier, the Supreme Court had also said that they will look into framing a guideline of sort on what are the factors that the judge should consider in the sentencing hearing. So all in all, this reference is essentially trying to plug the loopholes or the procedural loopholes in death sentencing hearings.
Okay, so now this 5-judge bench is going to look at the matter. What do we know about what happens next?
So this is a larger constitution reference. The Chief Justice has now to set up a 5-judge bench that will have to settle these differences in law. But the reference is effectively a middle ground between a complete abolitionist perspective on death penalty and actively advocating for death sentence. So this is trying to plug the procedural gaps in how death penalty is awarded. Because again, we have studies which show that an overwhelming majority of death row prisoners come from economically weaker sections, come from the scheduled castes, scheduled tribes, and the other backward castes. So in a system that is inherently unfair, how do you make sentencing in death penalty cases procedurally sound? That's something that the court is looking at.
And in the end, we talk about a new cybercrime hotspot. When the Mumbai Police Cybercrime Unit is looking for suspects, they usually trace them to UP, Rajasthan, Jharkhand, or even West Bengal. But recently, while searching for people who were involved in an investment scam, they traced them to Ernakulam in Kerala. And this caught them by surprise. And when they started looking into it more, they found that a lot of other investment scams were actually happening out of Kerala. In this segment, we speak to Indian Express's Mohammad Thawar, who recently reported on this matter. Mohammad, could you begin by telling us what the Mumbai police found out and what these investment scams are?
So investment fraud is when, you know, the person is telling you that you can invest in gold and we will give you this. Like the two cases that they have found, in one, the person had created a fake website where you could invest in gold and they were offering rates much higher than the government approved thing. In other, it was investing in Amazon gift card. Now, what they are realizing is that Kerala is a place from where these frauds are taking place. And generally, when it comes to cybercrime, they operate in hubs. So it's not going to happen that you will find one solitary call from Kerala or Karnataka or anywhere, because they kind of operate on scale because it is economically feasible for them.
Right. So, for example, the reason a lot of investment scams are happening from Kerala is because now the place has the infrastructure and the resources to carry out those scams.
Absolutely. So one thing that you have to understand, which actually is a very interesting thing, is that cyber criminals, one, will not target their own state. Their entire thing is, how do we evade law enforcement agencies? So if they are making calls from Kerala, they're going to make calls to Maharashtra, they're going to make calls to Rajasthan, Jharkhand, which also makes it difficult for law enforcement agencies to identify a particular area as a hub. Because here you have 5 officers in Mumbai who realize links to Kerala. Then in Rajasthan, then it's only after months that a lot of states come together and they realize that, okay, you know, there are a lot of calls coming from here. And that has generally been the case, that you know, you'll not have 5 people in a state doing that. There is a proper setup in place. You have like call centers, you have hubs, you have buildings where people are just involved. Like, you know, they have the same infrastructure and they're making like hundreds of calls daily or sending messages or whatever it is. But a lot of these hubs, they always operate on scale because it makes sense for them economically as well. So even in Kerala, like now, these are cases that have come on record. You have to understand that in cybercrime, if there are 5 cases that are registered, you can assume that there are 50 that are not registered. So, you know, in that sense, they realize that, okay, this is an area where we are finding links to, which we did not earlier. And also there are specific spots, like there is a place that they did not want to reveal the names of these places at this point because it could hamper their probe. But they said like there was this place to the south of Kerala. There was one along the Kerala-Tamil Nadu border. So these hubs will always be these particular areas in a state from where you will see a lot of calls and a lot of messages. So now they are fearing that, you know, Kerala does seem to be popping up, you know, in a few cases in Mumbai alone. So, and these cyber crimes, they take place across the country. So they're quite certain that this must be happening in other states as well. And so hence, they are also hoping that a local administration kind of looks after it and ensures that it does not really become more established than it is.
And earlier you mentioned that cyber criminals ensure that they don't commit crimes in their own state. And one of the reasons for this is also that it is difficult for the police from a different state to come and chase them, right? It requires a lot more resources.
Absolutely. So see, the reason why cybercrime has become such a prevalent thing is that here there is easy money and the chances of you getting caught is very limited. So a lot of times you will see that callers, you know, when you identify them as fraudsters, you tell them, I know this is a fraud. They will even abuse you. They'll tell you, you go and tell the police, because that's the kind of confidence that they feel they have, that, okay, you know, no police force from Mumbai police, they are not going to come for this one case to Jharkhand, things like that. So in that sense, you know, they ensure that there are layers that protects them from law enforcement agencies. Like I said, they will not make calls in and around the state that they are based in. Secondly, they are going to target states that are much further away from the home state that there is. And hence, they kind of have managed to evade law enforcement agencies. And only when, you know, like from a particular area, there are a lot of calls that are coming, there's a lot of pressure. I mean, eventually the cops do find out that, okay, the calls have emerged from here. So only in that case have we seen a lot of action take place. Although police forces do every once in a while go there, but for them, you know, like once a month, if somebody is coming and arresting two people, for them, economically, it's not that big a damage. I mean, for them, that's all right. Hence, they've kind of managed to flourish over the years.
And does the police say anything about why certain cyber crimes emerge from certain areas, like why investment frauds from Kerala or insurance frauds from Delhi or sextortion cases from Mewat, for example?
So I don't think that there is anything to do with these particular areas that give rise to these trends, but it is more so about moving on from as soon as a particular kind of scam stops working or people are more aware about it and the area is too much in focus, they then have to change it and go to another area. So it's more random in that sense.
And what does the police plan to do now that they know about these new hotspots?
See, there are a lot of awareness campaigns that are being done, but honestly, the scale at which this functions, like, you know, to reach out to everybody. So, for example, these fraudulent phone calls, like a lot of times we have also seen these fraudsters target senior citizens because, you know, they don't know technology that well. And it's not like cops will, for example, put a banners outside police stations in some places. But honestly, it's not enough to kind of reach out to a community as a whole. And also, like, these guys are making 100 calls or 200 calls a day. They will definitely find people who are not aware about it. So, you know, it's just the scale at which they operate that, you know, they will, like, the number of attempts that are made on a daily basis. You have people sitting and just making calls every day. So you will definitely find people. So, you know, in that sense, the force with which this operates, you know, is much, much stronger than the awareness that happens. These guys do it. They go to schools, colleges, they will put up banners, they will put up police stations. But unfortunately, after a point, especially in a country like ours with such a population density, with also a lot of people who do not, you know, let's say, for example, you do not read, consume media, who do not, like, if you read a report, you will be more careful. So there are people who are, you know, who are not as exposed to things. So that makes it all the more easier for them to kind of, you know, be defrauded.
You were listening to Three Things by The Indian Express. Today's show was written and produced by me, Shashank Bhargav, and was edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar. If you like the show, then do subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can also recommend the show to someone you think will like it. Share it with a friend or someone in your family. It's the best way for people to get to know about us. You can tweet us at Express Podcasts and write to us at podcasts@indianexpress.com.